History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
I think she would have been a very important person as an elder because she would have had a sense of the community background, where they came from, of all the reasons they did the things that they did.
On this International Women's Day, we'll go back 5,500 years to tell the story of one of Ireland's earliest farmers, the woman of the Burren. Also...
They took me out and closed the door, then grabbed my hair and then proceeded to cut off all my hair to the scalp with very blunt scissors.
Forced hair cutting during the War of Independence, how it was used as a weapon of war by both sides in the conflict. Plus, surfing on a wave of national identity in the north and how ladies' Gaelic football evolved from a novelty act to a national association. We'll explore some of the overlooked history of women in Irish sport. It's 51551 for your texts and at RTE History Show on Twitter. But to begin this evening, I'm joined by Dr. Ida Milne, history lecturer in Carlow College and a social historian of disease, who has written extensively about the influenza pandemic in Ireland 100 years ago. Ida, as an historian, you've spent 15 years of your life studying the social, the economic, the medical, the political history of the pandemic in Ireland. And you wrote an article for RTE Brainstorm this week about the many echoes and the lessons that can inform the present situation with the coronavirus or COVID-19 outbreak. One of those lessons is how to manage the panic related to the risk of infection. Just give us an idea of the kind of panic society experienced back in 1918-1919.
Well, you know, it has many echoes of today that you see lots of like conspiracy theories. Where did this disease come from? You know, was it a biological terror weapon? In 1918, they thought that Bayer was infecting aspirin with the flu, and that was a kind of a weapon, chemical weapon of war as well, you know, that they were trying to fight the war on another front. So all these conspiracies are very common. And panic is also common because people tend to think in crisis situations that governments are hiding things from them. And the way governments...
Well, they were right in 1918 because the reason why we called it the Spanish flu was because people were only aware of the fact that people were dying of flu in Spain, whereas they were dying in the trenches wholesale, weren't they?
Exactly. They were trying to keep it hidden from the enemy so that they wouldn't be weakened and the enemy attacked them where the flu was hitting. So right from the very beginning, I suppose, secrecy is built into the 1918 flu. And then people always think that something is being hidden. So the way governments can combat that is by being very open and making sure that they pass on good information. And the other, I suppose, way they can deal with panic is by making sure that information is really simple to understand. Because if you're ever in a panicky situation, you're trying to make a decision about health, like, for example, phone 999, it's very hard to be rational and to not panic. So you need information that's really clearly understood. And 1918 shows that, for example, the Local Government Board for Ireland issued this notice that you really needed a PhD to be able to read it. And it was full of long words and difficult concepts about disease. Whereas the Dublin Corporation and Sir Charles Cameron, who was a marvellous communicator, and journalists sought him out all the time, They issued really simple notices like, when you get the disease, go to bed and stay there until you're well better. A lot of people get ill from getting out of bed too quickly. Drink plenty. Do something to cure the fever. Really, really simple messages. You actually see that now in the UK and the NHS. They have a really simple drop down message. For, you know, so you can self-exclude yourself in different categories to look at it.
This was something in the way of a perfect storm. And obviously it was great if you happened to be a virus at that stage because you could travel very, very easily. But, first off, the trenches of World War One, you have literally hundreds of thousands, millions of men in very, very cramped conditions, very, very close to each other. Then that ends. Everybody goes home.
Yeah. And the soldiers, of course, then are kept with the live food for the army, which in those days, like pigs and fowl, are all vectors of influenza. So that's one of the reasons nobody knows where the disease came from for a long time. And then they all go home. They're all shipped across the Atlantic. The Americans, of course, when they enter the war, they're shipped really speedily across the Atlantic.
And what, 1.5 million Indians as well?
Yeah, yeah. 22 million, actually, Indians is the latest count. The count keeps changing all the time for
but
India.
But, I mean, would have gone back.
Oh, sorry, would have gone back. Oh, absolutely.
So they spread whatever they've...
Yeah, the Gurkhas who were fighting for the British in the war. Absolutely, sorry about that.
And, I mean, do we have any idea at this stage? I mean, I've seen all kinds of figures. Any idea of the numbers who died worldwide from the flu pandemic?
In 1918, it goes up and down all the time. 50 million plus, I think, my colleagues in the international flu community would say, is a reasonable figure, up to 100 million. But we still have no figure for China. We've no figure for Russia because it was at war. We have very patchy figures for Africa and South America. So, you know, it's a rough guide. And I think that's the thing we're learning, really, from this disease and other diseases. They're rough guides.
And how much of the mortality and morbidity would have been related to the fact that perhaps people would have been after a world war, physically debilitated, so therefore more susceptible to a virus?
Well, some people argue that that was the case, but equally one unusual feature of the 1918 flu, which thankfully doesn't seem to be happening now, is that it hit very strong, young, previously healthy athletes and people like that aged 25 to 35, which is one of the things that makes it particularly sad, because it's also the age group for parents of young children. So a lot of children were orphaned. But they think that's something called a cytokine storm, that when the body, in very simple terms, overreacts to the disease, the immune system kicks in and overreacts.
And obviously we've just heard that Italy has locked down essentially a quarter of the country. Were there any efforts made in 1918, or more particularly in 1919 when it had really taken hold? Any efforts made to quarantine, to lock down parts of the world?
This is something I'm increasingly interested in. Australia did try quite successfully. They managed to delay it coming in by keeping people in ships off the shores before and checking them for temperatures and stuff like that. But, you know, it's really surprising that we didn't, as an island nation, try to do that. And I think the reason for that, if some eventually we will find evidence to support that this idea was tossed up and then dismissed, because America had come in and we were very into the war, and we were in very important for America's effort in the war, if you like, because they were using our shores to and our bases to operate defences against the U-boats and to operate the convoy system to bring ships in and out safely from the war arena.
So not much in the way of quarantine anywhere.
Nothing
okay,
here.
So that's another reason why the morbidity would have been extremely high, because it was allowed to spread rampantly, more or less.
And also our railways were at the highest in Ireland, for sure. Our railways were the highest length ever in 1918.
Yeah, everything was public transport in those days. Yeah, so it made it easier to spread, I suppose. And in terms of infectiousness, contagiousness, whichever is the correct word to use, I'm never entirely certain. How would you compare the two? I mean, I know it's early days yet as far as COVID-19 is concerned, but how contagious was or infectious was
influenza? I suppose
influenza?
The amazing thing about the 1918 flu is that it spread to just about every place in the world. There were some islands, I think, in the Pacific that didn't get it. And it spread in a very short time. Very, very quickly, despite the lack of air travel that we have today. I'm told by a scientist who I work with, a virologist and an epidemiologist who have been very good to give me information, is that flu is aerosolized, and therefore it hangs around in rooms and buildings for longer, whereas this disease is a droplet disease. So therefore, they hope it's not quite as contagious or infectious. So, you know, that it won't spread as easily, but it doesn't seem to be very containable at the moment.
I mean, we also have, it's disputed what exactly the morbidity rate is, because in South Korea, for example, where apparently they have tested a lot of people and they have uncovered a lot of people who might have been suspected of having ordinary flu symptoms, in actual fact have COVID-19. So the death rate is something like, what is it, 0.6%?
Yeah,
whereas in other countries, it's supposed to be higher. But is that due to the fact that not as many people have been tested?
Oh, for sure. And I suppose, you know, the thing we have to come to understand is, again, numbers are somewhat notional, and they give you indications that where the disease is going to go in the most vulnerable sectors of the population. But in terms of an epidemic, you don't know the numbers until everything is over. Mm. And the rate of death, you can't be confident about it.
And what was the rate of death in 1918, 1919? I mean, now I think it's 0.1% for your average winter flu or influenza outbreaks. What was it back in 1918, 1919?
We use a rule of thumb in the international influenza humanities research community that it's about 2.5%, which is a hell of a lot bigger than we have, you know, the average for a seasonal flu. Mm. But I've seen lower case estimates than that, maybe about 1%, which would still give a much bigger, you know, a case for mortality rate.
I've also heard a lot of people talking about, oh, this will all be gone by the summer. Flu is a winter phenomenon. The good weather is going to end it all. Did that happen in 1918, 1919?
Not at all. This is a flu that actually began in summer, and that's why people found it so surprising that it was influenza, and they thought at first it was a plague. They thought it was some dreadful disease that came out of the war, and that they were talking about a dread disease. And it wasn't, you know, maybe for 4 or 5 weeks that they settled down to actually calling it a flu. So it arrived here in May, June 1918, but had been, you know, in America slightly earlier than that. And, you know, where it was before that, we don't exactly know yet. But it definitely was. Summer didn't seem to affect it all that much.
And tell me about the effects then in Ireland. How many people went down with the flu? How many people died?
Officially, 20,057, according to the Registrar General, died from flu. I have added in about 3,000 excess pneumonia deaths to that, looking, you know, taking an average over 10 years. 23,000. I think it's quite conservative because I think doctors were far too busy treating the ill to be that much worried about registering the dead. But from that, I estimated, along with Dr. Anthony Kinsler, who's a medical statistician, that there's probably about 800,000 cases on the island, about if the fatality rate is 2.5%.
OK, so you're not starting with a figure of 800,000 and getting 24,000.
No, because
so
we didn't
two
test
and a half,
all those
so you're,
people.
You're going in the opposite direction.
And so when I counted up the numbers that were ill in the towns and the reports and like that, that seemed about right. It was a kind of a comfortable figure that it seemed to suggest. So what it would do was silence entire communities and towns as it go through. You might see 2,000 or 3,000sick in a town like, say, Dundalk, or 1,000 in a town like New Ross, all under medical care at the same time. You'd see things like businesses shut down, not because of not because they were instructed to do so, but because the staffs were just gone sick. You'd see the Irish Times writing things like the better sort of client is sending out for their messages just now. Rather than risking themselves, they'd send out somebody to go for them.
Nice work if you can get it. Two of the things, I suppose, that are being talked a lot about this this virus, the economic effects and the political effects. Tell me, you know, what do we know about the economic effects? Just take Ireland, for example, the economic effects of influenza in 1918, 1919.
Well, you see businesses shut down over, particularly the
and
flu.
And not reopening or just shutting down?
They do reopen. They shut down for a time. So they're mostly closed down for maybe 3 or 4 weeks, or they'd be at half pressure for 3 or 4 weeks as the staff are sick and as people are not going out and about and not buying things. And partly that's because they're sick, and partly it's because they're self-quarantining, they're staying at home. Like you hear, I've come across quite a few people who've told me, for example, that they weren't allowed to go out there to, I've interviewed people who'd said they weren't allowed by their parents to go out to celebrate the end of the war in November 1918, which was at the peak weeks of the flu.
Yeah, because that's something that helped to spread the flu.
And it actually did, yeah, because about a week later you can see spikes in the deaths, and that's something I would be concerned about.
So those are parents who were very wise, and those are children, you spoke to those children, and had they gone to the celebrations, they might not have been around to talk to
you. I wouldn't have been talking to that lady at 104, you know.
Political effects, because it's become, I suppose everything is political now, but it's become very, very political. It's been politicised. It's been politicised in Italy, definitely in China. It's being politicised in the USA, and probably will be politicised in the UK. And who knows what's going to happen here, and to the extent it will be politicised if it spread. Were there political consequences at all?
Oh, well, it's really tied in to Sinn Féin's propaganda, and they're talking about the German plot, people who are in jail in Wales and England, and they say all the time, well, if anything happens to our people, you know, and then this disease comes along, and then they start saying, look, you know, this disease is around, what will happen to our people? Their health is already damaged. And indeed, Richard Coleman died just days before the pivotal general election in December 1918. And some people suggest that it did impact on the election toll, but it probably made people more certain of the way they were going to vote rather than having any big directional change there. But you can always see through the newspapers, even those newspapers which would have been very favourable to the establishment, like the Kildare Observer, for example. The journalists are saying, what are the people in the Custom House doing this? Why are they not being leaders in this? The Custom House, of course, being the seat of the Local Government Board for Ireland, which managed the Poor Law Union Health Medical Dispensary Service.
OK, and which went the way of all flesh a couple of years later when it was burned to the ground by the IRA. OK, and very little treatment available, obviously, at that time. That's one of the reasons why the fatalities
were in a
pre-antibiotic
area, so there's nothing to treat the secondary bacterial infections, which were a big factor with the flu, because the pneumonias took a lot of the deaths. There is nothing. People don't have a knowledge of things like paracetamol or they don't have home medications in the same way that we do nowadays. Whiskey would have been a major treatment. Even in hospitals, some of the eyewitnesses, the doctors who write about it, D.S. McNamara, for example, writes about it, and he says that oxygen wasn't used until it was too late. So, thankfully we have those kind of treatments now, even if we don't have enough for the numbers that are being predicted.
And even if we don't yet have a vaccine. Sean Beattie in Donegal text to say the Asian flu of 1958 is a better model for comparison to the present virus. Heidi Mill, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. And for more information and the latest updates about the virus in Ireland, as you heard in the news at 6 o'clock, two more cases where you can go to hse.ie. Through Her Eyes is a new book by Clodagh Finn. It recounts a new history of Ireland told through the lives of 21 of the women who shaped that history. Their stories span millennia and include soldiers, saints, scientists and sovereigns indeed. The book also goes way back in history with a profile of a Neolithic woman, one of Ireland's first farmers, who died around 3600 BC. Her bones were discovered in the mid-1980s, along with the remains of 34 other people in the Poulnabrone Portal Tomb in County Clare. The discovery has given archaeologists a deep insight into the lives of Neolithic farmers. Colette Kinsella chatted to Clodagh Finn about the life of the woman of the Burren.
The first thing that Clodagh Finn tells me is that there's a phrase that drives her nuts.
It's in this day and age. Such and such shouldn't happen in this day and age. Because it suggests that we've arrived at the pinnacle of sophistication. This woman we're talking about, who lived over 5,000 years ago, was so sophisticated. I think if you or me were catapulted back there, we wouldn't last jig time.
The time of back then, when the woman of the Burren was alive, is 3,600 BC. Her jawbone was discovered in the Poulnabrone Portal Tomb in County Clare in 1986. And this tiny specimen has given archaeologists an incredibly detailed image of what she was like. Quite literally.
If she were alive today, she would look most like a Sardinian woman. She would have been genetically quite small, and she would have had, very probably have had arthritis. Mostly in the upper bones, they would have perhaps been carrying something on their head. But what's very interesting, the wear is mostly on the left side. So we can possibly say that she was probably left-handed.
All that wear and tear is probably because of the lifestyle of the woman of the Burren. She was a farmer, a descendant of the first farmers who came to what was then a wooded landscape in flimsy boats 6,000 years ago, 200 years before she herself was born.
And they come from Anatolia, or modern-day Turkey. And they brought agricultural techniques with them. They brought cattle and sheep. And they brought this tradition of building monumental tombs that we see all over Ireland.
Including the portal tomb, under which the remains of the woman of the Burren herself was found. And as well as telling us where Ireland's first farmers came from, those bone samples threw up some surprises. The first one was the age of the woman of the Burren. She was around 55 years old when she died.
And the fact that she was 55 means she was some robust lady, because in the 4th millennium BC, you'd be lucky to get to 25 or 30.
But the surprises didn't stop there.
She probably had her own teeth, and all of them. In Poulnabrone Portal Tomb, they found 585 adult teeth. Guess how many of those had dental decay? One, no sugar. They would have eaten whole grains and nuts and berries and crab apples, a real abrasive diet, which was very good for the teeth. And there's evidence that they had animals, but they just drank milk. They didn't appear to be butchering them.
So all of this DNA evidence, combined with artefacts found by archaeologists, tell us that life for the woman of the Burren was turbulent.
Death was a constant visitor from violence, disease and hunger. But they knew how to survive. They had tools, they were potters, they were jewellers. Her house would have probably been more comfortable than, say, a medieval house or one of the mud huts in the famine.
And by all accounts, even their clothing was clever and possibly as sophisticated as the garments worn by Ötzi, the Neolithic Iceman whose remains were found in the Tyrolean Alps.
I'm telling you, it's like Prada, beautifully fashioned. The shoes use about four or five different materials, and they did some experiments on them, and you could walk comfortably for miles in them. So these were very sophisticated people who exploited the world around them.
But in terms of actually staying alive 5,000 years ago, your most important possession was knowledge. And because of her age, the woman of the Burren probably knew many important things that others in her community didn't.
I think she would have been a very important person as an elder because she would have had a sense of the community stories, the community background, where they came from, of all the reasons they did the things that they did. She would have been the Google, you know? Actually, do you know, it's very interesting. If you look around now and you see, look at these terrible floods, we haven't seen them in our lifetime. But you can imagine the woman of the Burren saying, oh yes, this happened two decades ago and I remember how we managed then.
And if the life of the woman of the Burren reveals a sophisticated society, so too does her death. Building the portal tomb under which her remains were found required skill, organisation and innovative thinking. And the careful placement of the remains of the 34 other people found inside the tomb suggests a community with strong spiritual beliefs, an ability to think beyond just day-to-day survival.
And I think it's definitely wrong to look down when we're looking back. We have a lot to learn from the people who went before us.
And that was Colette Kinsella reporting there, talking to Clodagh Finn about the life of a Neolithic farmer, the woman of the Burren. That's just one of the women profiled in Clodagh Finn's new book. It's called Through Her Eyes, A New History of Ireland in 21 Women, published by Gill Books. After the break, we'll be hearing about how forced hair cutting was used as a weapon of war in Ireland.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
The decade of centenaries has brought to light stories that were forgotten, or in many cases, never told in the first place. This is certainly true when it comes to the lives of women during the Irish Revolution, be they participants or civilians. We're going to hear now a story from the witness statement of Peg Broderick Nicholson, a Cumann na mBan member and an activist who was attached to the Galway Brigade of the IRA and was involved in IRA intelligence operations. The violent act of forcibly cutting off women's hair was widespread during the War of Independence on both sides of the conflict. In this account, Peg describes what happened when the Black and Tans visited her home.
I went down and snatched a coat from the hall stand. My mother shouted after me, "Be brave, Peg." I thought at first they were going to shoot me, but they took me out and closed the door, then grabbed my hair, saying, "What wonderful curls you've got," and then proceeded to cut off all my hair to the scalp with very blunt scissors. I might say they did not handle me too roughly, which is strange to say. There was no further comment until they finished, when they pushed me towards the door and said, "Good night." All spoke with English accents. I had to have my head shaved by a barber next day in order to have the hair grow properly.
The words there of Peg Broderick Nicholson from her witness statement for the Bureau of Military History. Joining me now from our Cork studio is Professor Linda Connolly, Director of the Social Sciences Institute at Maynooth University, who's been investigating the violence against women that took place during this period. Linda, you're very welcome to the programme. Tell us, first of all, what was the symbolic significance of cutting women's hair, aside obviously from the singular discomfort?
Symbolically, women's hair is very intertwined with sexuality. To cut a woman's hair throughout time was seen to attack her kind of virginal state in one sense, and then on the other hand was to humiliate her in the sense that she had a visibly cropped hair, and this was very, it stood out in the community. So symbolically it was about marking women out as sexually deviant in some kind of way, and we see the manifestation of this in Ireland in terms of the sexual policing of women who were seen to be too close to Crown forces on the one hand, and then on the other hand it was also a mechanism of social control of female sexuality. So it was a way of punishing women for their sexual behaviour, it was a mechanism of social control. But also it was really about marking out women who were the enemy as well.
OK, now there were two types, if you like, of attacks. One would have been attacks on women who were members of Cumann na mBan, who were associated with the IRA, who were working with the IRA. The other attacks would have been on civilians, women who had no connection whatever with the revolutionary struggle. Talk to us about Peg Broderick Nicholson, whose witness statement we just heard part of there, and also a woman called Agnes Daly, and why they in particular were singled out by, in this instance, the Crown Forces.
So what we see is the practice, if you like, being meted out in different ways depending on who was perpetrating it. And you gave the example there of Peg Broderick Nicholson in Galway, who was a member of Cumann na mBan. And what we see is that dozens of members of Republican families or of Cumann na mBan had their hair cut with scissors or razors. It was, I suppose, used as a way of intimidating to various degrees. I mean, the description there, it didn't seem to have been particularly violent, but it was intimidating. There was an air of threat and fear generated by it. Whereas we see other examples, such as Mary Alloway from Cove, in her witness statement, also a member of Cumann na mBan, it was a very violent beating associated with hair cutting in a night raid. So it was used to, as I said, target Republican families, members of Cumann na mBan, and women who were combatants in a way that perhaps was different than women who were civilians as such and weren't that involved in the conflict more directly.
And in the case of Agnes Daly, she was one of the famous Dalys of Limerick, sister of Kathleen Clark.
Yes, so a very prominent Republican family. And again, this attack appears to have been quite violent as well. She recounts how her hand was very badly cut. And it shows us that there is a tendency to treat forced hair cutting as sort of something that's perhaps lenient, but it is often accompanied with other kinds of violence, whether that be a beating, verbal abuse. There are other examples of women being taken away from the domestic space, so to speak, up fields, etc., or their faces being covered. So this is a form of gendered violence, really, where women's hair is the target. But as you said earlier, symbolically and also in terms of violence, it involved much more than just a hair cutting.
Would it be occasionally accompanied perhaps by even sexual assault? Would women, if they were sexually assaulted when their hair was cut, would they even report something like that?
As with all sexual crime at all times in history, including today, the vast, vast percentage are not reported, certainly underreported. You know, this is, I suppose, more difficult to ascertain. But having said that, we do have examples of sexual assaults accompanying hair cuttings. Or we have examples, I suppose, of sexual assaults where there isn't hair cutting either. One of the more famous cases in the War of Independence was in Dundrum, County Tipperary, where, you know, a woman was not just sexually assaulted, but she was also murdered. And, you know, an investigation into the Lincolnshire Regiment took place, which was only opened in Kew, in the Public Record Office, in 1980, the investigation. So we have examples of violence against women involving hair cutting. We have examples involving sexual assault. There are certainly less concrete reports of sexual assault than hair cutting, but that doesn't mean that we can presume that all of the attacks that happened didn't involve some kind of sexual assault, whether that was rough searching or whether it was actually rape was involved as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was a tactic pursued by both sides. So tell us something about the attacks on civilian women, in other words, women not involved with a common amon. In general, who carried those attacks out and why?
Yes, so we saw recently with the display of a sample of hair that was said to have been taken from a woman who had her hair cut in this way in County Carlow in the National Museum, generated some discussion about this. And we see examples of hair cutting on the part of the IRA towards women everywhere in the newspapers, in many of the witness statements. And the case in the National Museum led me to sort of look at the Carlow area in that period. And in the newspapers, there are numerous reports of hair cutting. They follow a pattern nationally that occurs in several other counties, such as Galway, Clare, Kerry, Cork, Tipperary. All these counties had high rates of hair cutting. And typically it was masked men, often 6, 7, even a dozen, who confront women, young women, who are considered to be either talking to British soldiers or in some kind of relationship with them.
Walking out, I think, was the expression.
Walking out is one of...
Lot, yeah.
Exactly. There's one in particular I just picked out. July 28th, 1920, the Irish Times reported that two girls in Granard County, Longford, were overpowered by a dozen young men and their hair was cut off because it was alleged they spoke to soldiers. Again, very typically, the girls had been warned. So this idea of sexual policing, of getting a warning that something worse was to come and that being followed through on, again, is very common and typical in some of the narratives.
The assumption would be that the men, the dozen men in that case and in the other cases, were members of the IRA and that it was sanctioned by the IRA. Would that be an incorrect assumption?
I think that's very difficult to tell in specific cases. You would need evidence. You would need to know who was involved in that particular attack. What we often find, as with much women's history, is you're really piecing together, you're trying to recover lost bits of evidence and recreate what happened. And also, if the men were masked, it's very difficult to tell. It seems to be the case that where there were prosecutions, that there definitely was an element that this was a strategy. And this is where we get into the territory of suggesting that hair cutting and the associated violence that I just spoke about, violence against women in war, gendered violence, is weaponized or is a weapon of war. That this isn't an isolated attack, it's something quite systematic occurring in different parts of the country.
Okay, well, let me put it this way. You mentioned prosecutions. Would any prosecutions, have you come across any prosecutions having taken place in Republican courts?
Not that I have come across. Certainly in the civil courts, there are some examples. I can give you one, which was the case of Bridget Keegan, whose hair was cut off near Toom when 7 masked men entered her father's house in May 1920. And in that case, members of the family testified and 3 brothers, the Jordan brothers, were sentenced to 6 months hard labour for the offence, with another man discharged. It's a particularly horrific case. They had revolvers. They took the girl out. She fainted and was unconscious, typically at night in her nightdress and the hair cut off with shears. And they said to her sister, "This is what you get for going with Tommy's." What's quite sinister, I think, about this case is as they were cutting her hair, and you can imagine how frightening that would be, you know, an individual woman being sort of forcibly held down by all these men. One of the men cutting her hair sang, "We are out for Ireland free." By cutting the girl's hair, he proposed to cut off her ears, but he didn't do so. The court case that ensued, the doctor from Toom, Dr. Thompson, said the girl was suffering from shock and was still under his care. It's an example of what I would call the hidden injuries of the revolution. You know, the psychological impact, the terror, that perhaps isn't captured in other kinds of statistics on casualties or fatalities.
Let me get your take on something unrelated to what we've just been discussing, but not entirely unrelated. Last week on the show, we discussed the controversy surrounding the cancelled plans to commemorate the RIC. What are your thoughts on that and on where this leaves us when it comes to future commemoration? Because lots of unsavoury acts were carried out on both sides during the War of Independence, and we won't even at this stage mention what happened during the Civil War. So yes. How do we address these events, and how do we deal with, and how do we treat, and how do we view those involved?
These are all very interesting questions. Some of the issues I'm talking about here, they're quite provocative. They challenge the prevailing narrative of commemoration and shed light on the more unsavoury aspects of violence towards women. And there isn't really as such a commemorative space for these women who had their hair cut, perhaps in the cultural domain, as we have seen in the exhibit in the National Museum recently of a woman's hair. There is more scope for commemoration. But by commemoration in the cultural context, I mean something, whether it's an object or an exhibition, which allows us to have a critical conversation with our past, which allows us to discuss questions such as violence against women and warfare, which is, of course, an important question even today in so many parts of the world. So that's a different kind of commemoration or remembrance than the state or official commemoration. Having said that, I think if the state is to commemorate the Civil War, obviously the War of Independence, there does need to be a place for female victims of the war, and perhaps less about recording fatalities and more about a broader understanding of the impacts of violence and how that has shaped the very foundations of Irish society. Women were not served well, as we know, in the aftermath of independence. And maybe some of the clues as to why that was the case lies in the prevailing attitudes to women that are evident in the kind of warfare we saw occurring both during the War of Independence and indeed in the Civil War, where we get into the territory of very transgressive violence towards women.
Professor Linda Connolly, thank you very much for joining us on The History Show this evening. And I should mention that Linda will be expanding on this topic as one of the speakers at the upcoming Hindsight Festival, a festival of history which is taking place from the 20th to the 22nd of March in Kells, County Meath, in association with Hinterland. The weekend of talks and panel discussions will feature some of the best known authorities on the War of Independence. You can visit hinterland.ie now for details on booking for Hindsight events, and we'll put a link on our own website. After the break, we'll be hearing about some of the overlooked history of women in Irish sport.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. A recent conference on women in Irish sport in Louth County Museum saw a host of speakers highlight the experiences and involvement of women in a variety of sports, past and present. I'm joined now by two guests, both of whom presented their work at that conference. Hayley Kilgallen is with me here in studio. She's researched the emergence of the ladies' Gaelic football in the 1970s. And joining me from a studio in Belfast is Dr. Rachel Telford, lecturer in sports development at the School of Sport at Ulster University, who has researched female surfers. You're both very, very welcome indeed. Rachel, you found that there hasn't been a huge amount of research on surfing culture in general, I suppose, really, in Ireland, not just on female surfers, despite the fact that it's a sport that has grown in popularity in this country since the 1960s.
Absolutely. There's over 20,000 surfers in Ireland, which could be quite surprising to a lot of people because it's just not a visible sport to many. And certainly in terms of the research, the focus has been on men's sports, men's team sports, particularly soccer and Gaelic football. And the surfing research has just not been there because the focus has been on the national traditional sports. But I would anticipate that'll change now that surfing will be in the Olympic Games. And Ireland will be sending a team to Tokyo 2020 for the first time.
And when did it really begin to emerge? Because in the 1960s, I mean, we would have associated surfing with the Beach Boys in California, and it was far too cold to surf in Ireland.
Absolutely. And it was one of the key families in Bundoran, the Britons, who went, Eastkey Britain's grandmother, she went over to California. It was on a tourism visit. She owned a hotel in Bundoran and was keen to learn from California culture and tourism. And it was out there that she saw surfing for the first time and saw the waves and thought, it's better back in Bundoran and bus bring some of these boards back. It could really help us with tourism back home. But when she brought the boards back, it was her sons who took them out into the water, and the tourists, when they came to Bundoran, never actually got to see them. So they were very much a pioneering family in Bundoran when it came to bringing the surf into Ireland in the 60s.
And again, the image that we have of surfing in the 60s and in the 70s was of bronzed gods, I suppose one or two goddesses, but mostly bronzed gods in California. That wouldn't have been practical in Ireland. So I imagine that it was the onset of the wetsuit that would have helped the development of the sport in Ireland in general, not just for women, but for men as well.
Oh, absolutely. And it was really towards the 90s when it really took off in Ireland, both for men and women. And you'll see more and more people even in the water in the past 10, 15 years as popularity has grown. But certainly we don't have the beach culture that they have, and it's still absolutely freezing and people are a bit mad to go out there in the water. But there isn't that culture. And I find that really interesting when it came to my research when I was looking at gender and women surfing. Because a lot of the time when you go out surfing, you have a full hood on, full wetsuit, and your body's fully covered. So when you're looking from the sand, you don't actually know if it's a male or female out in the water. So that raised some interesting questions, you know, when I was speaking to the women about how it interacted with their sense of self and their identity.
And I mean, pardon my ignorance, I know nothing about it as a sport, as a competitive sport, but is it a gendered sport? Are there men's competitions? Are there women's competitions? Are there any mixed competitions? Would they compete against each other, for example?
There's gender divisions, but I think, and it has been very gendered in the past, but certainly now that the Tokyo team are going out, like it's three men, three women, and it's very, very equal. And surfing as a sport in general is equal prize money when you go up to the higher levels. So it's, you know, follows it in the likes of sports like tennis, which I think is really, really positive when it comes to men and women's participation and being seen as equals in the sport.
And how did you seek out female surfers, and what kind of thing did you or did they tell you about what the sport means to them, and perhaps about some of the disadvantages that they had to overcome?
Well, I had friends who surfed and they kind of pointed me in the right direction of key people like Eastkey Britain and other high-level surfers in Ireland, pivotal women who had really kind of changed the face of surfing. Zoe Lally was one of them, who had started her work with the Irish Surfing Association back in 1995, and she's been really pivotal in the growth of women's surfing. So it was great to speak to those kind of pioneering women, but also their families, and really understand how surfing in those local communities around the coasts of Ireland was really part of their national identity and where they were from. But equally speaking to women from Northern Ireland and other parts of Ireland who maybe weren't from coastal towns, that they very much saw it as an escape from their national identity and some of the national sports that they've been involved with. And it was very much a freedom from all of that. So it was a real mix of experiences in terms of identity and national identity and why the women were surfing.
As it's a relatively new sport to this country, is it or has it been historically less gendered? Has there been less discrimination? Are there fewer advantages for women to have to overcome?
I think it has been very gendered when I was doing the research, but I think it leveled out, has started to level out a lot quicker than other sports. I think it's interesting maybe because it is out in the sea and it's not a spectator sport, and the communities that surf are very close-knit communities. There's a lot of support from the Irish Council, Sports Council, in terms of funding, like Women's Weekend specifically, and trying to get women out in the water, trying something new and something different. So my experience is where it has been gendered, but it very much is more equal playing field now.
Hayley, you've been researching the emergence of ladies Gaelic football in the 60s and the 70s. Your paper was very interesting because it begins with a letter written in 1967, which was published in the Sunday Independent. And when you read it, certainly you read it now, it seems like it's more appropriate to 1967 BC. Tell us about this. Tell us about the letter, about a letter from a Cork farmer, which hopefully wasn't typical of 1967.
Well, it may have been typical as well. I think it gives an interesting insight into the place of women in Irish society at that time, but also in sport. So this farmer wrote to the Sunday Independent calling on the GAA to ban women from attending the upcoming All-Ireland finals. He said that women would take up valuable space in Croke Park, But he went a bit further, saying that the sight of women outside the home up in the city for fun and enjoyment was revolting and unnatural to him. But what's significant here, I think, is that all the responses that were published by the Sunday Independent a week later all argued against the farmer, and they came from men and women. They said that women were human beings, not mechanical instruments, and that if the GAA was a male-only organisation, as he said, then match attendances and gate receipts would be much lower. So I think it gives an interesting insight there into women's place in society at the time and the way society was reassessing the traditional role of women.
OK, I'm assuming that he was probably in his 60s or 70s when he wrote the letter, so he's probably turning in his grave at the moment. The title of your paper was From Novelty Act to National Association. And in the 60s, before the establishment of the Ladies Gaelic Football Association in 1973, 74, was that what Ladies Gaelic Football was, a novelty act?
Yes, we first start to see ladies Gaelic football to appear at carnival tournaments in the late 60s, and it was advertised alongside traditional carnival activities like tug-of-war competitions and dances. And it was seen as an activity that would just bring in a bit of extra money, I think, to these carnivals. And at the same time, you start to see workplaces and county associations organise tournaments themselves, often for charity. In 1969, a tournament took place in Tipperary that between local businesses and offices that was a charity tournament. And the Offaly County Association included Ladies Gaelic Football on their county sports day in 73. And as a result of these festivals and other charity tournaments, there's evidence that by 1973, it was played in about 16 counties, or had been played at that time, but mainly on a small local scale.
And was the rise of the women's movement, which would have been in parallel with this, was that of any significance? I mean, obviously, you know, Betty Friedan wouldn't have given a toss about, you know, the All-Ireland or Gaelic football, but nonetheless, things were happening in Ireland. So was that part of it?
Yeah, I don't think you can ignore the fact that there was a strong women's movement at the time, and that definitely created pathways for women to get involved in public life more than they had previously. But in the research I did, I didn't find any motivation from the women who were playing Gaelic football to do so out of a feminist kind of agenda. They were just looking for an active social life outside of the home, and that was their main driving factor to play Gaelic football.
And then how does the formation of the association come about in 1973?
So in 1973, it was a real turning point for ladies Gaelic football in that an inter-county match was organised between Offaly and Kerry. And in the absence of a national association, this was billed as the first All-Ireland final for ladies Gaelic football. And it was organised by Brendan Martin of Offaly, who the cup today is named after. It attracted a good deal of media attention. It was a feature in both the Evening Herald and the Evening Press. But what was significant here was that the Offaly County Board supported this match, and they included it on their club fixture list for the 29th of July. So it exposed it to the wider Gaelic Games community as well. And the Evening Press, in their post-match report, noted that many people who came to jeer at the women playing Gaelic football left the ground in admiration. So I think it shows there as well how it was seen as a novelty act to many people who just came to see what the women were at.
Tell me about the 1977 final, because that certainly drummed up a lot of publicity, thanks to Sister Pauline.
Yes, so in 1977, Roscommon reached the All-Ireland final and they were to play Cavan. But prior to the All-Ireland semi-final, one of their players, Pauline Gibbons, left to take her vows as a nun in England. So ahead of the All-Ireland final, the Roscommon County Board wrote to her mother superior and asked for special permission for Pauline to play the final, which her mother superior gave her. And
her.
I believe Sister Pauline was nicknamed George Best in her convent. But unfortunately, despite the prayer said, Roscommon ended up as runners-up and Cavan were All-Ireland champions in 77.
Good old Cavan. And one of the headlines was Big Match Prayers for Sister Pauline. I'd say there were a lot more headlines. But it wasn't until 1982 that the GAA officially recognises the LGFA.
Yeah, and delegates from the LGFA and the GAA did meet a number of times in the 70s, but it's unclear what came out of these meetings. And in 1982, Mick Fitzgerald Fitzgerald, the LGFA president at the time, simply recalls being handed a scroll in the Gresham Hotel. So it seems like it was an unceremonious affair, but an important one nonetheless. It was a huge step in recognising and legitimising ladies' Gaelic football.
This has nothing to do with history, and this is obviously just a personal opinion. We're going to ask you anyway. Is it time to drop the L?
I think we're definitely seeing it in other sports. It's much more common now to see women's sports referred to as women's Gaelic football or women's soccer. But I'm not quite sure if it's there yet. Although, interestingly, the Irish version of ladies' Gaelic football is Cumann an Pailgeal na mBan, which is
right, yeah.
Women's.
Yeah, things often sound better in Irish than they do in English. I presume you would welcome it, yes?
Exactly, definitely would,
okay.
Yes.
Rachel, this kind of historical research, has it been neglected? Because obviously sports history is much more important and is far more widely studied in our universities now, for example, third level education, than it was before. Is the study of women's sports, do you think it's going to enter the mainstream?
Absolutely, and I think it's definitely needed because if we're going to celebrate women's, you know, achievements in sport, they need to be chronicled. You know, we need to have those records in place so that we can trace that back for future generations and they can see all the amazing things women have done in sport. Just because they're not visible there in the media doesn't mean that they haven't achieved those things. So I think it's really important that academics and people in their local communities, you know, record all the amazing things that women have done in sport.
Well, thank you both very much indeed for joining us this evening. We're going to have to leave it there. Hayley Gilgallon and Rachel Telford. My thanks also tonight to Tommy O'Sullivan on sound and our researcher Liz Gillis. Our reader tonight was Fiona Lucia McGarry. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE Radio. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.